I don't know. I don't know where you got your information from there, Jason, but I did not give in to Joe. And I firmly believe that the GM and the player are playing two different games. That being said, I too would like to hear what Andy has to say about it, because he is very insightful, and perhaps he can explain it better than I can. I think that the first level player and the 10th level player are playing the same game differently, which is kind of what he's saying, but the DM and the players are not. So, there's my definitive answer, and if you want to join my OnlyFans, I might get more into it from the, you know, from my hot tub with the in a bubble bath.
There's a rather interesting debate going on over on Discord at the moment, on the Audio Dungeon Discord, where a lot of us anchor RPG podcasters spend probably too much of our time. It's a rather interesting debate between two of the greatest intellects on the Anchor Discord. Alternatively, you could say it's like two bald men fighting over a comb. But that would be unfair, because I don't think either of them are bald. Maybe thinning, but they're both luxuriant and beautiful men. And the debate, well, I mean, to be honest, the debate itself is not the interesting thing. The question itself, you know, what I mean is, it's not about whether who's right or wrong, but of course, you know, we all know who is right, and you'll find that out in a minute. The question is, are the GM and the players both playing the same game? Now, the answer to this, obviously, is no. They are not playing the same game. But it's interesting to think about why this might be the case. And to be fair to Joe Richter, who holds the opposing wrong position that the GM and the player are all playing the same game, I think we should acknowledge and think about why that might be the case. Daniel Norton of Bandit's Keep, also an old friend of mine who I've played with a lot and who has probably GM'd me more than most people or anyone. Actually, that's not true, because I did play for a year in Curse of Strahd run by another good friend of ours, Marco. But the point is, it depends on how you look at it, really, doesn't it? Because obviously, on a superficial level, yes, we are all playing the same game because we all come together to play the game. Therefore, by definition, we are all playing the same game. But that is defining the game as a temporal instance, okay? A moment of time, a period of time. And that is not the only thing that the game is. The game isn't just the 2 hours that you spend together. Far from it. And if you think about all the other things that need to happen for that game to exist, be that GM prep or character creation or backstory creation or map drawing or you know, time spent sitting on the bog, on the toilet, on the loo, pondering, thinking about you know, how a certain situation might resolve itself. You know, all of this is happening outside of that game time, and yet it is part of the game. So, yes, in one sense, we sit down for two, or, well, back in the old days when we sat round tables, maybe even more like 4 hours, and we would all participate in the same event, but that doesn't mean we were all doing the same thing. And I think that's where this sort of confusion, not confusion, because no one's confused, I think this is where this difference of opinion arises, is that I think, you know, in my opinion, and I... Good God, there's a gigantic fire behind... fuck me. I'm just driving along and I just saw in my rear view mirror a huge fire on the freeway in the opposite direction. And there's a massive traffic jam coming. I am not going to come back this way. I've just, wow, there was fire engines. I think there was some kind of, I don't know if it was a car crash, but it was probably, it looked more like an engine fire or something. There was a lot of smoke coming up off the road. Holy shit, that was dramatic. I've completely lost my train. I hope no one was hurt. I've completely lost my train of thought now. So, let's get back to that. How am I going to get back if I can't go along that freeway? Because that is not going to open up. I'm going to have to think. But let's get back. So, there are so many other levels on which the GM and the players are not playing the same game that I think that the counter-argument of temporal instance is not strong enough. It's not strong enough to overcome those other differences. So let's just start with the engagement with the game, with the rules. Now, the rules are a monolith, let's say. They are a thing. They are a singular thing, the set of rules. And yet, the way that you interact with them as a player and as a GM is completely different, utterly, utterly different. The player is given a, let's say, a window into the views, the player window. It's almost like, let's say, on Roll 20, as an example, you have the player view and you have the GM view. The GM can see everything. The GM sees all the moving parts. The GM also knows what rules they are and are not using, and can decide what rules they are and are not using. The player cannot. The player cannot. And I think this is where a lot of antagonistic player GM sort of interactions stem from in the past. Is this asymmetrical availability of the rules to the player and the GM. And perhaps that gets to the root of really the simplest argument why you're not playing the same game is that the players cannot manipulate the rule structure. And the GM can. The GM fundamentally can and fundamentally should because it's their game and they need to decide how they're going to run it. We all manipulate the rules as GMs. And we all make rulings as GMs. The players cannot make rulings. The players can propose something, let's say something's a little bit outside of the written definition. The player can propose something, but in the end, the GM has to decide how that is interpreted. Maybe it's a vague or unusual situation where rulings have to be applied and interpreted. I'm not saying that the GM becomes some totalitarian fascist, determining everything and not listening to the players. No, of course they should be cognizant of what the players want and sensitive to that. But in the end, they have to make a decision because that might have a lot of knock-on effects further on down the line when that rule comes into play again or when that situation arises again. So just on the basis of the rules alone, I think we have a very strong argument to say that they're not playing the same game. Now, the second thing, of course, is it's sort of allied to this. It's the ability to see behind the curtain. The GM, of course, their experience of playing the game is deciding when and where to reveal certain parts of that game world, that game experience, that story, to the players. Of course, a lot of that is driven by decisions that the players make, but again, they cannot decide when to lift the curtain on a certain part. That is entirely up to the GM. So the narrative is not equally controlled, no matter how much we like to say we are doing collaborative storytelling. The narrative ownership is not equal. The GM controls vastly more of the narrative control than the players do. And And from their perspective, it's almost like they're tuning the engine. They're tuning the engine. They're choosing the fuel. They're setting the gear ratio and all of that. And the players are almost like the drivers of the vehicle that the GM puts in front of them. They can decide which direction they want to go, but they can't control the other traffic. They can't decide when a stoplight is going to go from red to green. The GM again does that, and therefore the experience is fundamentally different between player and GM. And then the final aspect, and I could go on a lot longer, but I won't, because I want to dedicate the rest of this episode to Daniel. The final aspect actually is in the characterization, is in what you do, the role that you play in the game, the role stroke roles. Now, not all games are like this. There are games where you share a single character, and there is no GM. Actually, no. Those that I'm thinking of everyone is John, and that there is a GM in that. But there are games where there are no GMs. There are games where you share characters. But the vast majority, the player controls a single character. They embody a single character. So their emotional connection to the game is based on what happens to that character, how that character gets expressed in the world, the things that they do, the things that happen to that character. Now, of course, the GM is playing every other character and the world and the monsters, and the metafiction and everything. So the identification is completely different. As a GM, I do not at all identify with any of my NPCs. If you do, I personally believe you're being a shitty GM, because you should not be identifying with any of them. You should not have favorites. You should not try and keep them alive. You should not really care. You should be, well, not care. You should be very neutral about the outcome for your NPCs. And that is not what you should do as a player. And I'm saying should a lot, and I'm going to get dinged for it. But really, I believe that. I believe that as a player, if you don't care about your character, why are you playing? That is your interface to the world. If you don't care what happens to that character, then it means you don't care about the game. As a GM, if I care about my NPCs, it means that I'm going to manipulate the situation, because I have that ability, to favor those NPCs to ensure that they survive. Now, I'm sure we're all tempted to do that from time to time as GMs, because sometimes certain NPCs are just more fun, and the players enjoy them more. But I think you are letting yourself down, and you're letting your players down if you do that, because you're bringing bias into it. You're not letting events emerge as they are intended to. So your emotional interaction with the world as a GM is not through character identification. But what is it through then? I think it's a combination of things. It's a combination of the pleasure of seeing the players interact with the world, the fun of perhaps, driving endless stolen cars. Like they say, when you're playing one shot, drive it like it's stolen. You can care to some extent about, and I suppose one shots are different, because there you shouldn't really, you shouldn't care that much about your character, because you really just want to drive it off a cliff, basically. But in a way, the GM is having that pleasure constantly of driving the NPCs off a cliff. He can be as cruel and as malicious to the NPCs as he wants. He can put them through the worst tortures imaginable, and it's all fine. It's all absolutely fine. So it's kind of like this great machine that I say he, she, or other, are putting these these entities, these virtual entities into to see how they'll react, to see what will happen. So the emotional connection is through the pleasure of construction and not in through identification. That and I think that means you are playing a very different game. And my personal evidence of this, my personal experience of this is that's why I don't really like playing, is that I don't get that much of a kick about identifying with a character, not in this deep way that players do. And maybe the counter argument is that not all players do deeply identify with their characters, and maybe they shouldn't. But it's a different type of identification, and I don't, I find it limiting, and I find that my pleasure comes from seeing how the machine works. Plus, I'm a control freak, as I've admitted many times. Right, well, this has gone on too long. Now here's a bunch of calls from my good friend Daniel.
Hey Andy, Daniel from Bandits Keep. Apparently, Apple did not want me to listen to your podcast. I was wondering because I heard some people saying, "Oh, Andy's podcast." I was like, "You don't see a new one." So I am really far behind, but I'm calling in now. I guess this is this little kind of after the game. You guys are having a chat, and one of the things that you talked about is well, because Barney, I think it was Barney, it was like, you're gonna bring in the horror earlier. And I mean, I think I'm gonna see where this progresses. Obviously, I'm really far behind, but. I think having the horror right up front, the horror being like dangerous horror up front in a long-term game is not the way to do it at all. I think if you want a serious horror, you've got to have this like, is there something happening? And it should be more creepy than right in your face. With the exception, I mean, depends on what you consider horror, I guess, right? If the horror is just like there's somebody murdered and it's pretty gruesome, that type of horror, but you don't want to see that monster, right? You don't want to see any of that stuff until the end, which is what I think Call of Cthulhu. In their terribly railroad. Oh, I'm getting caught.
Terribly railroaded. I thought we'd done this. I thought we'd finished with this. Oh, fuck's sake. Fuck's sake, Daniel. I don't think you know enough Call of Cthulhu. Call of Cthulhu adventures. Anyway, but yes, horror up front. I think it comes down to whether or not we're going to run a long term. I think you're absolutely right. But I don't think we're going to run long term. I think we're going to do like maximum two, possibly three sessions. And I obviously know that you've left some more messages, and I think you go into a bit more detail later on. But I think for a short one, I think you do need that urgency, but to create a horror atmosphere, then yeah, I guess the classic way is to build tension, but you need to also show peril. So I think it's delicate. I think it's delicate how you balance it. Also, killing off one of the PCs in the first scene, that's a bit that's an interesting thought, isn't it? I mean, it's almost like those old days when you kill off one of the PCs just to let the players know that you're not messing around. I think there's a degree of antagonistic GM-ness there that I don't like, but I also quite like the idea of getting players scared about what the stakes are, getting them to know, the gloves are off.
What was I saying? Oh, in their very well put together adventure paths, Call Cthulhu does that, right? They wait till the end before they kill you. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not. I mean, I'm gonna see where you guys take this, but I think something else was mentioned, and again, I'm not. I should be taking notes. But also in the morning, where they're talking about, or Spencer was talking about the idea of playing, being the main character or the main character in one episode, and then be taking kind of a step back as the role of like an NPC, not really an NPC, but I mean that's not how I would do it. And another one is kind of a good idea. It's almost like if you think of a TV show where they have like the episode that's about it, this character, and the other ones are still there, but you know they're not the focus of that episode. You could certainly do that, right? You could have one of those for each of the PCs so that, people are aware, like, it's okay, Barney, this is your episode. It's about your character. And everybody knows to kind of take a step back from the spotlight so you can focus on that one character and any, psychological torturing you want to do for them.
Okay, so you sort of saved yourself there at the end. But again, I don't think I think you're thinking of the shorter adventures, which yes, they are all constructed in this way where the investigators are finding out more and more stuff, and then at the end they meet the horrible Gribbly and then they die. So, and I think that is more like the short scenarios that you probably have read or run, even. I know you've run The Haunting, that's for sure. Although I think we didn't die at the end of that. I can't remember. No, we didn't die. Or did we? Who knows? But Haunting's not particularly deadly, really, once you figure out the knife and all that. But their longer campaigns are not like that at all. Mask of Nyarlathotep used to be like that. It didn't used to be get through to the end and then everyone dies. It would be you get 2 pages in and then everyone dies, and then you go another, and then you get to page 4 and everyone dies. But they have changed it, and especially with the introduction of pulp, as you know, because you're playing pulp right now with me, it's eminently survivable. So, but I suppose there's a difference between inevitable death and a railroad, and we probably don't have time to go into that. And I know, well, I've even cut that clip out where you were railroaded in the very first session of our Berlin game, the Dancers of Vice, Horror and Ecstasy that you played, that we've played to a successful conclusion, you will have to admit. Right. Again, really nice idea of moving the spotlight around. And I think you can also use this same structure, the same mechanism there. I'm going to use that word. I think you can use the same mechanism to also emulate horror in a really interesting way, because in a good horror film, everyone dies except the final girl. We know all that. In a really good horror film, you don't know who the final girl is. Well, I say that, but of course, the classic Halloween, of course you know who the final girl is right at the beginning. But I think that is your classic slasher movie, and I think that they've had to evolve a lot since then, because you can't just keep doing the same thing again and again, to the point where you don't necessarily know who the final girl is. Or the final boy, or if even there will be a final girl or boy, or whether everyone will die. So I think this idea of moving the spotlight around, of having different characters played by different players, and different, shifting the camera around, I think that's interesting. I'm not sure I am ready yet to do something like that. We're already be trying to do a lot that we've never done before, which is mainly not making dumb jokes and laughing. That's enough of a burden without having to go into some really highly thoughtful structural changes to how you run the game. But interesting stuff. Thanks, Daniel.
Interesting, you're talking about having the players kind of be antagonistic to each other. I personally don't like that, to be honest with you. If one player was the bad guy, which is kind of like I think what you started that kind of part of the conversation, and nobody really knew it, that could be interesting. But then I feel like that's like scheming with the DM behind the scenes, which I don't know if you want to get involved in. That feels a little railroady. Oh, you might be okay with that. But yeah, not my cup of tea, but hey, if that's what you like. Maybe use paranoia, right? Because in paranoia, you're all like trying to screw each other over, right? So yeah, anyways, I'm looking forward to what everybody says here.
Everyone trying to screw each other over. I think that says more about you, Daniel, than it says about me. I don't know. I think for a one shot, PvP could be kind of fun. I think that again, if we're talking about horror narrative, the setup where everyone is highly antagonistic towards each other, and there is this suspicion and tension in the camp, I think that can create great horror. Yeah, I wouldn't want it for a long-term campaign. God, no. I don't think anyone would. I think it'd be just exhausting, and you'd end up all hating each other. Or maybe not. I mean, antagonistic games are actually the majority of games that are out there. Most games are not cooperative games. Most games you are trying to beat everyone else into submission. Not role-playing games, but other games. I by the way, for anyone listening earlier, I am now going up the mountain road to avoid that probably gigantic traffic jam going into that freeway fire that I saw on the way here. And rather nicely, it means I'm driving past the old house, so it's kind of nostalgic. That's why it's a bit bumpy and noisy. Anyway, we played Paranoia, Daniel. Do you remember when Henry ran us through Paranoia? I actually really enjoyed it. And having listened to a Paranoia actual play on Roll, there's a podcast out there I've come across called Roll to Save, I think, which is a bad name for a podcast because Roll for Initiative and Save for Harvest, it's like very confusing. I think it's called Roll to Save. And the chap doing it, he's really into Warhammer, and but he there's a Paranoid actual play on it that's really good fun, and I really enjoyed it. I don't know how I found that one. Anyway, yeah, I think it could be fun.
Andy, Daniel from Reddit's keep calling in on your TSR episode. as usual, I'm calling in before you finish. But it's interesting because you say when you reach 50, you're set. And I wonder though, is that the case? I feel like in the last couple of years, as I'm approaching 50, I don't know. It's like all of a sudden it broke again, and I'm flexible again. And I think for me, the reason why is because I am interacting with younger people, not like children, but which is maybe what a lot of people do at this age, but more like people in their 20s, And of course, this is a very big time where a lot of things are going on, being brought to the surface. So a lot of conversations is happening, and I think it's really interesting. I think we can change even as we get older, but I do agree that it's much more difficult.
So, as the old saying goes, you get dirty when you get 30. So, I guess it means you get naughty when you get 40. But I don't know what that means when you get 50. Shifty? You get shifty, thrifty, nifty? Can't think of any other ifty words. Ifty. Maybe you get a bit ifty. Anyway, yeah, I'm going to agree with you, actually. I'm going to disagree with myself and agree with you. You have this effect on me, Daniel, where you help me reverse my opinions on things quite often, which is good. It's good. Because, yes, you're right. I only started podcasting at the age of 50. That's a bit of a weird thing to do, to start doing when you're 50. And probably quite a lot of the anchor people have a similar experience. But God, I never thought I'd do anything like that. I was always a listener. I didn't even imagine for a minute I would ever make my own podcast. So yeah, that happened when I was 50. Was I 50? It was two. It's a little. No, literally, it was a month after I turned 50. Not even a month. 20 days. So I was 50 on the 23rd of November, 2019. And I started podcasting on the 10th of December. So it was 17 days after my 50th birthday. So yeah. And also, I started gaming, for seriously started gaming when I turned 50, because all right, that's not true, because I had been running campaigns for 5 years previously, but that's when everything exploded, and I think it was also the COVID thing and playing a lot of games online. But I suddenly became much more invested in my hobby than I'd ever been. So, and likewise with you, being surrounded by younger people has had an effect on me to some extent. But I think one thing that has ossified, has petrified, is my, oh, I don't know, my idealism, and that's sort of inevitable. Schopenhauer, the disengagne, the disillusionment, the constant process of disillusionment. The idealism has gone, and to some extent, the sort of political engagement, political will. I'm like, yeah. My beliefs aren't so strong anymore. They really aren't. I think that sort of eroded away. And maybe that feel that's why I feel like I'm kind of. It's gonna be very hard, I think, to ever get that stuff back. Which is a sad admission, but it's true. But a lot of other things have changed. So, yeah. All right. You're right again, Daniel. You're right.
Speaking about the equality, I understand what you mean, and I agree on a lot of levels, but I also try to look at it as, sure, we're giving something up, but to bring the equality, to level the playing field, right? But we're also gaining so much, right? We're gaining these people that are different than us. They have different opinions, they have different backgrounds, they have different thoughts, and that is so much more valuable than anything that we're losing. It's what are we losing? That we're not going to have all, he written in every book. I mean, who cares, right? We get all this really interesting stuff that we can engage with, and amazing people that we can bring into to our gaming, whether it be at the table or whatever, or reading their work that they put out. I think it's super interesting, and I think actually we're living in an amazing time. And yeah, it's unfortunate that those with hatred have allowed.
We are indeed living in an amazing time. We are on the cusp of something, I feel. It could be disaster or it could be something kind of cool. But this is, I think, why we see so much tension and friction at the moment, because there's so much change happening, and for some people it's wanted, it's desirable and great, and for others it's a terrible ending of something and a terrible loss. So it's a tough one. I need to get out because someone's just blocked in my wife. So yeah.
All right, I'm resending that message. Now I'm not on the train, no longer railroaded. All right, so I think I was saying, oh, I think because Carl was like, maybe you can break people up, or like they do in horror movies. But I think in a game that would be difficult because you kind of want to keep everybody engaged. I think in your conversation with the group, you kind of talked about that. Like you can't have a bunch of players just watching another player do stuff. They'll come out of the game. That's going to kill any hope of having them like be fully immersed in the fear. So. Yeah, you got your work cut out for you there. But I have faith. I have faith that you can do it. And I am continuing traveling quickly from the past to the future, and I will see you soon.
Thank you, Daniel, that you've got faith. Not many people do. I, including me. The more I think about it, the more I think we are doomed to fail. But we will see. We will see. We're having our session zero on tomorrow, actually. Tomorrow, gosh, it's crept up. So we will see. Yeah, but you're right. Don't try and do too many things in this. We're already venturing into the unknown, splitting the party, risking losing people's attention. I guess you could run a lot of single one-on-one sessions. That might work, but I find them weird. I find them weird. I know you've done them. Okay, let me recap, because I did one recently with Nikki to round off Ghost Jekyll Killer, and it was cool and I enjoyed it, but I couldn't do it for more than half an hour, I don't think. And maybe that's okay. Maybe you do half hour. All right. Maybe.
So, spoiler, even though we're actually in the future, so this has already happened, on the last day of the course, of course, it tells you that you if you don't finish, you can finish it later. So, not a big deal. Actually, I should thank you again because you pointed that course out to me, and I ended up taking it. I did the D&D one, of course. I was trying to figure out what writing a 5e module will be like. And I think the course is pretty good. For anybody interested in those kind of things, I think these courses are actually pretty interesting. There was things that I feel like I probably knew, and there was things I didn't know, but I just think the structure was really nice. So, yeah, I enjoyed it. So I do appreciate you having pointed that out to me. Maybe I will take the Call of Cthulhu one next time and become a horror writer.
I absolutely think you should. I think you would make a great horror writer. Your games have always horrified me. I sit there thinking, why am I playing this? No, you have this way of conveying horror in a really good, I was going to say creepy way, but you're not being creepy. The horror is creepy. And I think you have this sort of deadpan approach to GMing that I find it's the opposite of mine. And I think you would be a far better person to run a horror game, a genuine horror game, than myself. I know you have said some very complimentary things about my Call of Cthulhu GMing, but I think theoretically you are better. That sounds like faint praise, but yeah, if we're talking about unsettling the players, you're pretty unsettling, Daniel.
Andy, Daniel, Bands Keep. Of course, I can't wait till you're done talking before I have to call in. Yes, Dying Earth is probably that's probably one of my favorite fantasy stroke science fiction series to be inspired for RPGs. I think it's definitely sci-fi. And actually, since you said it's been a while since you read them, in the first book of the short stories, there's a bunch of sci-fi. In fact, they have basically a flying machine and stuff in one of the stories. But even in Eyes of the Overworld, when Kugel was first dropped off on the other side of the world to get the eyes, and he kind of escapes, he meets that woman who's riding this thing. It's kind of if I remember, it's been a long time, but it's kind of like this machine with multiple legs. And so I feel like there is this weird mix of sci-fi mixed in, which I really love. I love that mix. And I feel like that is D&D for me. I mean, we played our characters. I never read Dying Earth until I was an adult, but we played our characters like Kugel. And yeah, he's definitely probably chaotic. Or maybe neutral evil, as I understand alignment these days. But one thing that I really like about it is that he doesn't, he's constantly avoiding as much as possible getting into fight. Everybody is. Everybody flexes their muscles, but very few people actually fight, which I love. I think that's one of my favorite ways to play RPGs, where nobody's really ready to pull their guns, you know, but they're all willing to threaten it. So, yeah, anyways, I'll listen to the rest.
Seems like we've hit another hot button topic. Jack Vance, Dying Earth. Your good pal Joey, he does not like it. He bounced off it, he said. I love that image of bouncing off a book or a piece of music or a film. It's very visceral. It's like you kind of, it's this thing, it creates a field, a sort of artistic field, and you're kind of heading towards it, and then you just get repelled, you get pushed off. I'm sure we all know that feeling. So yeah, he bounced off it, and also talked about, I think he went and listened to it a bit after we were all giving big kudos to Jack Vance, and he noticed how rapey it all is. And yes, Jack Vance, there's definitely some sketchy shit in there, that's for sure. You know, the time he was writing, but also, you know, he's presenting human awfulness in all its various guises. So, you know, there's underage sex, and there's rape, and there's awful things done to people, innocent people. Yeah, but no villain doesn't get his comeuppance. Everyone does in the end pay for their crimes. So I suppose there is a moral core somewhere. It's not in any of the characters. It's just in the way the world deals with those characters. And yeah, the sci-fi fantasy mix. I'm with you, Daniel. I'm totally with you. I think I did mention that it's you know, obviously it's set in the future, and the magic is a sort of almost a technological feel to it. But yeah, you've expressed it better than I did. And I think, yeah, I think that's what I'm going to enjoy about running it for you in 2027 when the book arrives.
Just so I don't forget to call in about it, I did the Lankmar box set, well, and the other one, but the Lankmar was the big one, like Dying Earth. And yeah, you still need the book for it. I wonder though, about Dying Earth. Depends on how much they change, I suppose. But the Lankmar one, you was basically a set of supplements that work with the regular DCC, so you still need the main book. But I don't think you'd have trouble using Mutant Crawl Classics as your background, to be honest, if you wanted to go that route. But you can always get the DCC book pretty cheap, and they're always coming out with cool new covers. So, you know. Okay, yes, I admit I have three different core books. Anyways.
Yeah, who am I kidding? Of course I'm going to buy the DCC core book. You know, this is a one-way street. This is a railroad. This is a one-way street, this hobby. Once you start buying, you can't stop. You become unstoppable. So yeah, I guess I'll have a peruse of which of the many beautiful covers there are to get. Yeah.
Yeah, it is interesting, right? I'm trying to think of when the DMG came out, but in the Moldvade Basics set, Clark Ashton Smith is listed, of course, in the back as one of the inspirational readings that you should follow up on. And there's also a expert module that's based on, you know, Clark Ashton Smith's world. So it's really interesting that Gygax kind of gave him the cold shoulder. Who knows why?
So I didn't look this up, so this is from memory, but I do remember a discussion I had. So yeah, the DMG was 77, 1977. The Holmes Basic was also 1977, which surprised me. Moldvay didn't come out till 1980. Now I'm pretty sure I got those dates right. If I haven't, I just stand hang my head in shame. So maybe it's, you know, maybe in those 3 years. But of course, Moldvay wrote the basic, so you know it's his opinions as much as anyone else's. You know, I've been listening actually to a lot of Clark Ashton Smith over the last couple of days. The one I just finished is The Door to Saturn, which is fantastic. I think that's the second. I think it's the second collection. The first is the end of the story, then it's Door to Saturn. Now I'm on to the fourth. I don't know what happened to the third. Or I'm on, no, I'm on the third, which is A Vintage from Atlantis. Also brilliant. They actually seem to be getting better, so I'm revising my opinion. I just think that the final one, the fifth one, the I can't remember what it's called, but the fifth one. They seem to be just a sort of ragtag collection of odds and ends, but yeah. But he is. I think his sci-fi stories are more interesting, more compelling than his fantasy. I keep flip-flopping because I do like Zothique and Averroine, but they're a bit kind of standardized. I don't know. They're a bit, you know, they aren't as quite as distinctive. But his sci-fi is really distinctive, and his sci-fi is almost always sci-fi horror. The one I just finished, and actually I clipped it out and I sent it to Barney because it's almost like a companion piece to the one where they go to Venus, I think. I think they go to Venus and meet all these horrible, these horrible continent-sized organisms. But this one is about going to Mars, and it's called The Seedling from Mars, and it's brilliant. It's brilliant. So if anyone wants to track down a really good Clark Ashton Smith sci-fi story, it was written in 1931, and I think it inspired a lot of the classic sci-fi movies. Essentially, a spaceship lands in Berkeley, in the San Francisco Bay area, which is just hilarious. And a spaceship from Mars lands, and it either kidnaps or some local scientists get taken with it. I think they get kidnapped, along with the mayor. The mayor of Berkeley, I think, and the police chief. It's a bizarre setup, but it's and they get taken back to Mars, and there they encounter this planetary organism that can base it's basically somewhere between a plant and an animal, but it's incredibly super intelligent and advanced, and it can grow extrusions that can mimic human beings, and so it can communicate. It learns how to speak in like 5 seconds, because it's never had to speak before. It's the only entity on this planet, and then you find out eventually why it's the only entity. But it's a great story, and I won't give away any spoilers. The Seedling from Mars. It's wonderful, and it has this very jaunty, and also horrifying kind of subtext as well going on underneath. Which is great stuff.
Okay, now having listened to the whole thing, I think in theory Barney is right. You want to do something in the beginning so you know it's horror. But I mean, that's why a lot of movies and stories have something happen off camera, right? Somebody not in the what would be the party dies. How are you going to pull that off? I do not know. I feel like if any of the horror happens to somebody in the group right away, that is probably not going to be the most interesting thing. Because the first thing I would think is, okay, well, they had the scary dream. They're going to survive, or they're going to die. And I don't think you want to set that up at the beginning, but I could be wrong. What do I know? Very little. And even less about this. Of course, you're now starting to say what I said. You're not done, but I will forget if I don't say it now. Since you are doing a radio play, that is, it's not being put out live like the way that I stream live with no editing and none of this shenanigans that you do. What you could do is cold open with something that's from the end of the play, right? You start off, you do your normal play like you normally would, and record the whole thing through. At some point, there's going to be some huge dramatic scene at the end. You start the radio play off with that scene, then you cut back, and then you go forward. That way, you know, again, it's done in editing, right? Like they say with a movie, right? A movie's written three times, right? When you first write it, when you shoot it, and then in the editing room. So because you have that power of editing with your media empire, you know, and I just have to go direct live feed like some local newscaster, I can't do that. But you at Grizzly Peaks Radio can do that.
So, very much like your suggestion, we are now circling back to the beginning because we're pretty much back to your initial set of messages. And again, brilliant, brilliant stuff here. Lovely idea, lovely idea. Both, you know, and I'll begin with your final idea about having the flashback structure. Start with the ending and then flash back. I think that's brilliant. I think there are some logistical issues that I'd have to get my head around because, you know, it takes a long time to edit these and sometimes takes even longer to schedule the game. So I'd have to be really careful about how, you know, I think it'd have to be a limited number of sessions and then knowing when the editing schedule would work to get that clip so we could release it in a meaningful time frame, but you know, as opposed to a year later, because I don't like I do sit on some of them for a year, some of them I have sat on for a year, but I really don't like that. I like putting them out much closer to the time that we play them, which I'm trying to do now. But you know, particularly with the Berlin ones, because well, one I personally love them, and two, it seems our fans really like them as well. They get really good download numbers compared to some of the others. So, and talking about Berlin, I think that's a good example of how you can use some kind of structure like that. If you recall from our game, there were not just one, there were actually two sort of prologue elements to Dances of Vice, Horror, and Ecstasy. The first one we've already put out. It was in the very first episode where you encounter Well, no, not encounter Anita Berber for the first time, because the other people did meet her in the first story, but first get exposed to her art, and which of course leads to some fun stuff, which of course I railroaded you into, and you hated, but also, and this hasn't been released yet, so it's a little spoiler. There is this other horrible sequence of events that happens, at which point time skips forward by 2 years, and I think that's another structural thing you can do, as well as having the flashback, flash forward. You can move time on. You can play around with a lot of these narrative forms in a really interesting way. So Daniel, thanks for all these epic messages. I hope you keep ringing in. I know I've been very bad with putting out episodes, especially those if you're not even seeing them, because of iTunes has decided I'm not relevant to you anymore. Yeah, so much good stuff to look forward to. The next Berlin campaign, finishing our Mutant Crawl Classics tonight, actually. It's Friday. We will be finishing our Mutant Crawl Classics tonight, and then in a few weeks' time, we'll be starting the final chapter of Berlin. Maybe I can try out some of these ideas on you then.
It's a game we're role-playing. I'm a stranger and you're making mistakes.